My dearest friend in college was Violet. Violet with the appropriately huge purple eyes and straw-colored hair. Violet is incredibly kind, but almost too honest. If you said, "Does this look good on me?" she felt compelled to tell you the truth instead of what you wanted to hear. She wouldn't fib, even on little tiny things. All the truth, all the time. Violet was from a tiny town on the Ohio River, which is in southern Ohio. It makes up the border between Ohio and Kentucky. A cruel person would say it was a river rat town, since there was no money since the coal mines had pulled out, and the drinking water was filthy from power plants. A town that was lied to over and over again by big corporations that made a quick buck and then ducked out with the lumber, or laid off hundreds of people, or scarred the earth. Childhood poverty left Violet tiny, 100 pounds at her very heaviest as an adult. Her doctor insisted, drink milkshakes, eat pizza, but no matter what she ate, she was still so small. Weight wouldn't stick on her sharp bones, and she was sick a lot. Perhaps that's why Violet was so honest. All those lies had crushed her laid-off father and his father before him, crushed her very body's ability to hold on to weight. All those lies were why there was a huge incidence of childhood cancers in town, why you couldn't swim in the river. But the glorious green trees the glorious green hills were swathed in tall trees and surrounded the town. And deer tiptoed through tire gardens, and geese called out over tall cattails. One train came through late at night. The town had maybe 300 adults total. Last time I was there in about 2005, a pint of beer at the one local bar cost 75 cents. And if your dog or your cow ran away, you didn't have to worry or even put up flyers because someone would bring it back before long. They knew it was yours. Violet's town was deeply religious, conservative in that rural Baptist way. Parents were to be obeyed, wives were to submit to their husbands. Sunday was for church and family and never, ever work. Violet got married in the little church there after college to a local fellow and promised to love him until death did them part. And Violet meant it, every word. She promised. The thing is, soon the promise became hard to fulfill. Jeremy started to drink a lot and got fired from one job and then another job because of being drunk. Violet was worried and begged him to go to counseling or AA. Lots of people in town went to AA, but he refused. "You promised till death do us part," he said. Jeremy started abusing prescription painkillers, and when Violet threatened to leave him, he reminded her, "You promised." Then he decided she must be cheating on him and insisted he go everywhere that she went, even to work. He sat outside her office in the car and listened to the radio the whole workday. It was humiliating, but it was so much worse the first time she got a black eye from him. It was scary. He started locking her in the house when he wasn't home. And every time she complained, he said, "You promised." And she knew she had. And she didn't want to lie. She had promised before God and her family and heck, the whole town. So she didn't leave. One day, while she was locked in the house and Jeremy was away, her pastor came over uninvited. She couldn't get out and she couldn't let the minister in, so he stood outside the apartment window and talked to her through the screen. He was worried. The bruises were obvious. And Violet let it all pour out. She had promised, but, and she knew she had to stay, but. The pastor was quiet for a few minutes and then said, "You know, promises aren't meant to be used as weapons or as bars. But Jeremy is using your wedding vows, sacred oaths, to imprison you. He made promises too that day to honor you and cherish you. And is he doing that? As they say, the scales fell from Violet's eyes, and she saw the abuse and the terror, and that her good faith promise wasn't meant to become a prison sentence. And she popped out the screen of the window, and she reached out for the pastor, and her being so teeny tiny, he lifted her out like she was a doll. And she was never imprisoned by doors or false covenants again. Promises or covenants are made by couples getting married, made by parents at child dedications, made by doctors before they begin practicing, and ministers when they are installed in a congregation. Often they are beautiful and unifying things. Often when I meet with an engaged couple to talk about the wedding ceremony, the vows, the covenants they'll make to each other, are the most glorious part of the wedding preparations, because at their core are covenants of individuals promising to give up some aspect of their own self-interest for the good of the pair. They covenant because, as Janice Marie Johnson wrote, together we will be stronger, together we will be wiser, together we will be gentler. Our congregation is built on a covenant, a set of promises that we make to each other. This is the foundation of all Unitarian Universalist churches, the covenant. You see, in nearly all faith traditions, there's a creed that serves as the church's center. Most Protestant congregations and all Catholic congregations say a version of the Apostles' Creed, which starts, "I believe in God, the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth. I believe in Jesus Christ, his Son, or his only Son, our Lord. He was conceived by the power of the Holy Spirit and born of the Virgin Mary," and so on. This creed is recited frequently, and it reminds people this is what we believe. Believing in all of this is why we gather together, this particular group of people. If you believe in the creed, then you know you belong. And if you hear the creed and it's not what you believe, then you know that's not your church. In a lot of ways, it makes a great deal of sense. These creeds work for Orthodox churches. Remember that word, Orthodox, meaning one way, ortho, one way, one path. In most congregations, people affirm the same set of beliefs, so they're Orthodox, one way. Our congregation and all Unitarian Universalist congregations are heterodox, or many paths. We don't all affirm the same beliefs, so a central creed wouldn't work for us, or it would be incredibly long and have a lot of buts and ands. Instead, we have covenants, promises that we make to get to each other, that we make to affirm how we will be in relationship together. Instead of a creed stating what we all agree to believe, we have a covenant to guide us in journeying together. As a tribe of individualists, of renegades and rebel rousers, of a group of people who are proud of our nonconformity, we need a covenant to make plain what kindnesses are expected in this church family. In 1998, this congregation, after a series of gatherings entitled Fulfilling of the Promise, created and adopted a covenant of good relations. You can find it on our website under the Get Involved tab, Mission and Vision, or you can ask Lori in the office for it. She'll print it off for you or email it to you. It's a really, really well done covenant. You folks really nailed it on the covenant. The introduction reads, "We, the members of Shoreline Unitarian Universalist Church, agree to treat ourselves and each other fairly and respectfully. We commit ourselves to improving the quality of our lives as individuals and as a community. We support one another's self-improvement, continuing spiritual growth, and use of our skills and talents in beneficial and responsible ways. The Golden Rule is an excellent standard for human relations. Do to other people what you want other people to do to you." Not too shabby, and that is just the introduction. I'm impressed. This covenant isn't just pretty words. It carries a deeper intention. We agree to treat ourselves and each other fairly. we support each other in responsible spiritual growth and self-improvement. We will treat each other the way we wish to be treated. The covenant has 7 short sections. And the first is a covenant you make with yourself. I value myself and take responsibility for my well-being. I will balance my needs with the needs of other people. I can express my concerns and my limits clearly. I like that the covenant starts out with personal responsibility, because all covenants start with a person having to take responsibility for themselves, for their reactions and their needs. What if every time I said the word God in the worship service, someone who doesn't like that word stood up and screamed at me? No, it wouldn't work. We're a faith community, and we have to express our concerns and our limits clearly. What if you felt compelled to say yes to every request you got for volunteering in the congregation? Every request for help at coffee hour and ushering, every request to a committee or the choir or some team, and you were exhausted. No, you can express your limits clearly and take responsibility for your own well-being. Well, next the covenant turns to how we will be together, member to member. It reads, "Healthy community results from actively listening to one another as we share our individual experiences, strengths, and hopes. I try to settle disagreements directly with the person involved. When unable to settle a dispute, I can forward my concerns to the appropriate persons. Our congregation makes decisions by the democratic process. I will actively participate in this process and will respect the outcomes of our collective wisdom. I reserve the right to say no, and I will honor the right of others to do the same. Yet I always seek to achieve harmony by compromise and persuasion." Good stuff. Next is the really hard part. "I do not engage in harmful gossip. I respect the private and intimate bonds of other people and do not exploit another person for my own needs. I respect the confidentiality and private disclosures of others. I am accountable for the roles and tasks which I assume. I want to be sensitive to my emotions and the emotions of others." The really tough stuff. "I will settle disagreements with the person involved. If I'm upset with Joe Smith because he didn't include me on the choir email blast, I will talk to Joe about it, not everybody in the choir. I won't go straight to the minister or the choir director unless I feel unsafe around Joe. I won't gossip about who looked like they were flirting with a new religious education teacher. I won't tell folks at work what individuals say during joys and sorrows. I won't exploit another person for my own needs. I won't raise money at church. I will respect Joan Smith's no if she doesn't want to be an usher." Although, who doesn't want to be an usher? They have a lot of fun. Perhaps these examples have reminded us all covenants aren't easy. It's hard to be responsible for our own emotions and not gossip and respect the democratic process and take disagreements directly to the person that you disagree with. And sometimes we fail to keep our covenants. Sometimes, despite our best intentions and our hardest work, we come up short. And that's why covenants aren't contracts. Covenants are made to be audacious and daring and risky. They are a great leap to show us how far we can go and where we could be our best selves. Sure, a contract would be more realistic. A contract would just say the basics of what we already know we can do. A contract would say, "I will show up most of the time, often late, and often impatient, and I will try to keep my gossip to a minimum." Our covenant, like our 7 principles, is more audacious than that. It dares us to be more than we have ever been. It dares us to see if we can hold the community as the precious gift that it is. Covenants are not contracts. We do not use our covenant to beholden each other. Our audaciously gentle covenant is not a weapon. When our covenant is broken in this community, it's a serious matter, but it's forgivable. When our audacious covenant is broken, the people involved will meet with me and we'll find a way to be whole again and to seek repair and to be drawn back into community. And if a person can't abide by our covenant, if they won't seek repair, if it's too big a task to be in community without damaging that community, they'll be asked to leave. Because as Janice writes, we covenant to be committed to each other, to consider each other as significant, to consider each person as valuable. If we are to be our whole selves here, our vulnerable selves, our tender, gentle selves, we must be gentle and respectful of each other. Just as my friend Violet couldn't honor her wedding vows and her abusive marriage, we can't function as a church family if we don't honor each other and seek repair when we fall short. Violet is now married to a gentle and caring man, and she has 5 little boys. 5. She kept trying for a girl. Just have one more. She ended up with 5 boys, and she finally stopped. She is really, really happy. Really happy. Being in a healthy marriage is still a lot of exertion, but it's the joyful kind. It's the worth it kind. Like a loving marriage, there's nothing easy about being in covenantal community, but the effort is so worth it. As Janet writes, our covenant stands firm. It is our embodiment of faith in each other. It is our blessing of each other. It is our commitment to each other. May we hold this community as a precious gift. May we hold our relationships as a gift that transcends borders. May we carry forth the intention of our covenant, the audacity of our covenant, the promise of our covenant, now and in years to come. May it be so.